Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, Adora.
Hey, what?
Did you know that once you get in orbit around Mars, you're just a few minutes from the surface?
We call it the 7 minutes of terror.
7 minutes of terror.
Because from the time you slam at the top of the atmosphere until you have to gently land is about 7 minutes.
That's right. Backstage at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, director Charles Alachi should know. He's experienced that 7 minutes of terror more than anyone else on Earth. At JPL, they land on Mars, and their eyes on the universe never close. So we have a question. What would you do if you could grab a 3-day weekend in space? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, May 7th, and John's coming to us from KPCC's Pasadena studios, not far from that window into the galaxy. We have a lot of news to get to today. The death toll estimates in Myanmar have risen to 100,000. Some want to know if Senator Hillary Clinton faces an impossible mission. And on Broadway, there's some new faces in the crowd. We have more headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello, good morning. Hillary Clinton is pushing on in her race for the Democratic White House bid, despite increasing calls for her to drop out. She has events scheduled today in the upcoming primary states of West Virginia, South Dakota, and Oregon. Barack Obama will be in Washington today. 5 days after Myanmar, also known as Burma, was hit by a tropical cyclone, aid agencies are having trouble getting permission to enter the country. We spoke earlier this morning to Joe Lowry from the International Red Cross. He's negotiating with the military government.
We're working very hard negotiating with the authorities to get visas for as many people as we possibly can, and we're optimistic that we'll get all the people in that we need over the coming days.
Burmese state media says more than 20,000 people have been confirmed killed by the tropical cyclone, and some estimates saying the toll could be as high as 100,000 dead. Iraqi soldiers are ordering more than 6,000 people in Sadr City to leave their homes. It's the first time residents have been asked to leave. The move signals a new push by the US-backed forces against Shiite extremists after 7 weeks of intensified fighting. China's health officials are reassuring a terrified public they have nothing to fear from an outbreak of a highly contagious intestinal infection. The enterovirus 71 has killed 16,000 people this year, including 28 children. The virus is spread by contact with blisters. Another day, another record for oil prices. Light sweet crude hit $123.93 per barrel on the Asian markets today. And in the US, the Dow opens at 12,814 after a loss yesterday of 206 points. And the time is just coming up to 4 minutes past the hour. Hello, John.
Thank you, Femi, for that sobering enumeration of the troubles here on Earth, which may motivate people to think about maybe leaving Earth for a while. That's our question today. We want to know, if you could go into space, where would you go? Who would you take with you on your 3-day space weekend? Are your bags packed, Adora?
Absolutely. We're talking about 3 days, and we want to hear from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can write to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Where would you go? Where would you go, John? Who would you take?
I think Mars, I'd definitely take my wife. We'd get
that
away from
would
the
be
kids.
Good.
Yeah, I'd be.
But why Mars? Everybody wants to go to Mars. We've seen pictures. How about someplace else?
You'll find out.
We'll be back.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
This morning, UN officials are confirming that the first aid plane has landed in Myanmar in the wake of Saturday's devastating cyclone. They say it's bringing tons of food and medical kits. The planes had been waylaid on the tarmac the last 2 days, awaiting the junta's clearance to land. to take off and then land. Death toll estimates have soared to 100,000. Graham Bowley is following the story for the New York Times. Graham, it sounds like relief efforts are moving forward.
Hi, Adora. Yeah, what we're hearing from our correspondents is that the first aid is on its way and is arriving in the country. The United Nations World Food Programme has sent an aircraft from Dubai with high-energy biscuits and medical kits and storage tents, and it says it expects two more aircraft to follow soon.
Now, there seems to be a contradiction here because the military leadership has said, has appealed actually for international assistance after the deadly storm, but they've since been dragging their feet on issuing visas to relief workers. Do you have any sense of how that's progressing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a very big issue, and progress has been slow. The movement today seems to be the first crack in the door by the government allowing in food aid. There are still negotiations going on about this type of officials that can follow. And the U.S. is ready and is in negotiations and may actually be close to an agreement to get visas and to get officials in to help distribute the aid. But there are real worries about that. And although the aid might arrive, say, in Yangon, the main city, there may then be real problems about distributing it, and there's a real need to get people in there to help.
Clearly, this is a very desperate situation. The government has been saying that at least 22,000 people have been killed and another 42,000 are missing. But we're also seeing today some increased estimates to as much, to as many as 100,000 people dying or going to finally that would be the total death toll here, in part because of concerns about disease outbreaks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yesterday, I mean, the government so far has said sort of 22,000 and 40,000 plus missing. Nobody really knows, and we're not sure if the government really knows in Myanmar. But the U.S.'s most senior diplomat yesterday said, you know, we're looking at estimates of 100,000 based on information from an aid organizations in the country. If conditions worsen and if aid does not get in, this is the scale of the disaster we're looking at. And indeed, time is really important now. We're 5 days into the crisis since early Saturday when the cyclone struck. And in these sort of situations, disease starts to spread. And we have sort of a very short window, aid organizations are telling us, to really help the situation. And already we're 5 days into it with no real movement until today.
5 days into it, and there are still some areas that continue to be underwater, and relief workers are beginning to trickle in. Graham Bowley, New York Times, many thank you.
Thank you.
Also in the news today, Hillary Clinton.
The outlook for the Clinton campaign looks bleak.
And the math just doesn't work.
She says she will soldier on.
The ball's in her court.
Everyone's waiting for a signal from her on how to go forward. Anything can happen.
I think effectively the race is over.
That's lots of talk on the airways, even more here in New York, Senator Clinton's political base. Some of the papers are saying it's over for her. Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein's here, and you just told me publicly political leaders are saying they're continuing to back her, but privately some of them are saying something else?
Everybody is going around asking everybody else, calling everybody else, saying, when is she going to get out? Is she really going to go through with this? There's a lot of doubt, and looking at some of the headlines today in the New York papers, the Daily News has a picture of Obama, and it says it's his party. The New York Post says over the hill. Even the New York Times, it's a double column lead story. Support for Clinton wanes as Obama sees finish line. There are people walking around New York City wearing Obama T-shirts and putting on their Obama buttons. And the sort of thought consensus is that it is over and it's only a question of time. Of course, that's not what she says. She says she's in it until a nominee is chosen.
I was actually just going to ask you that, which is she's moving straight ahead, although you've said she's issued a schedule. But yesterday, you certainly didn't get the kind of email traffic from the campaign that you're used to.
No, compared to Pennsylvania, after she won the Pennsylvania primary, we were getting emails through the night saying she's raised $3 million online. And then it was later in the day she's raised $10 million online. We were getting all kinds of statements from her campaign. In the normal course of a day, we'll get maybe two or three policy policy statements. We'll get statements on issues of the day, for example, Myanmar, the situation there. We'll get new advertisements. Yesterday, the only emails I got were an announcement of a conference call in the morning, and then Bill Clinton's schedule, which they usually issue every evening, came out around 7 in the evening. So it feels like a very different campaign just from the sort of reporting end of it.
It's interesting, and it's kind of sad, I mean, because there's an enormous effort that's gone into this campaign. I guess the question that I have for you, Andrea, is what is the end game? I mean, you can't really just tell Hillary you get a speech and, you know, nice job at the convention. I mean, what's the negotiation here?
Well, I think the problem for her is that, okay, first of all, yes, she has been counted out many times, including by yours truly, who thought it was going to end. But the math is just so difficult here. And even some of her staunch supporters, like California Senator Dianne Feinstein, are saying that it's time to end it. So the question is, if she prolongs it, does she end with a very, very bitter legacy in the Democratic Party? And the question is, if she indeed is getting out of this race, how to do it in a way that maximizes her power and her political future.
Let's talk about the numbers for just one second. And they vary a bit depending on what source that you're looking at. But let's just take the New York Times. They're saying that Barack Obama has racked up 847 delegates to Hillary Clinton's 1686. That's a difference of somewhere over 150 delegates. There are estimates that in order for her to catch Obama, she would need to win 88% of the remaining delegates on the table.
That's insane.
Andrea, that would be not only unprecedented, but she hasn't gotten 88% of the vote in any state.
It's almost impossible, because even in the states where she's done fantastically well, because of Democratic Party rules about how the delegates are allocated, she's only come out with maybe 10, 20 delegates, even on her best victory nights. And to sort of close a 200 gap, according to Democratic Party rules, would be almost impossible, even if Florida and Michigan are allocated exactly the way she wants them to be, she still wouldn't be able to surpass Obama.
She knows these numbers well. Let's take a listen to what she said in West Virginia.
I'm staying in this race until there's a nominee. And I obviously am going to work as hard as I can to become that nominee.
She's marching on, very clearly saying that she's not going to stop. But we also learned yesterday that she had to loan herself somewhere in the neighborhood of $6.4 million, presumably to keep her campaign going. Doesn't that signal certainly that there is a lack of support out there if donors are not giving her enough money for her to keep going?
Well, it's been an extremely expensive campaign. It's gone on a long time, and there have been a lot of television ads to buy. So, I mean, she's raised more money than anybody ever in the history of the United States, except for Barack Obama.
I wonder what interest rate she gave herself on that loan.
It's not like she's doing badly in terms of
fundraising.
That's
a real subprime mortgage situation there.
But, yeah, I mean, she has spent all of her money, and, you know, we have not gotten any sense that there's this overwhelming swell of grassroots support. And the question is, who's going to give her money now? Her staunchest supporters have maxed out.
But that was part of their strategy, we should point out, which is they went after the big donors for the checks of $2,300. There's only so many of them, as opposed to Barack Obama, who's gone after everyone. And some people are giving $25, and other people are giving $2,300.
Right, he had a real new economy, internet-based business model. And it seems to have proven to be the superior business model in this election. I mean, I'm sure it's extremely hard for Hillary Clinton these days. I mean, she is somebody. It's a bit like the figure in the Monty Python movie now, the Holy Grail, where her arms and her legs are chopped off, and she says, "I'm not dead yet." I mean, they're sort of like everybody else thinks it, but she doesn't think it. And, you know, they may push on until the numbers come her way, but how much negativity does that draw towards her? She wants to remain an influential person for the remainder of her career.
That's really the question.
I mean, as always,
really quickly, is there any way that this morphs into a reexamination of the super ticket in any sense whatsoever? Or is there just so much bad blood? There's no way these people are getting together. I mean, the numbers are extraordinary. They can trounce any Republican.
I think it would be unwise to rule that out or rule it in.
Okay, we're going to catch a few headlines for Femi. Okay, thanks very much, Andrea Bernstein, our takeaway political director. Femi, what do you got?
It is 17 minutes past the hour. Just a quick look at some of your headlines for you. We're starting your day with news that former Clinton supporter George McGovern says Hillary can't win the nomination and he now supports Barack Obama. And that's a look at your news.
Femi, thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
34-6 O'Buck. We're trying to get something going here so we can get the spacecraft into a safe state without having to trigger it on board. So, with any luck, we can do it within the next 15 minutes.
Roger, copy.
That was some sound from the radio at Mission Control at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. We're going to hear a little bit more from there in a minute. But right now, Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor of Essence, has joined us. And our takeaway question today is, Patrick, if you could spend a weekend in space, where would you go and who would you take with you?
I'd reunite the members of Parliament Funkadelic for a weekend jam on Uranus.
Uranus with the Funkadelics. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, John.
Oh, that is great. I love that.
Have you had your Tang yet?
Yeah, I drink Tang all the time. It's IV to me. Well, you know, let's just say that we are talking about space because I'm out here in Pasadena at Southern California Public Radio, KPCC, and I had a fabulous backstage tour of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory where their eyes on the universe never close. And the first thing that's amazing when we met Charles Alachi, who's the director of the JPL, is how, I mean, he's like the admiral of a space fleet. There's not just one or two spaceships up there. There's a whole lot of them.
As we speak today, we have 17 spacecraft across the solar system.
17?
17.
That's
and
quite
I'll
a few.
Show you where we're monitoring all of them. And they range from the two Voyager, which are leaving the solar system, Cassini, which is in orbit around Saturn. We have two orbiters around Mars and two rovers. We have a spacecraft heading to Mars, which will land in 2 weeks from this Sunday. We have a number of spacecraft orbiting the sun, spacecraft heading toward comets, and we have Earth-orbiting spacecraft, which are telescopes or Earth-looking, you know, astrophysical telescopes.
It's like
so it's kind of fun being in a place when you have 17 spacecraft
yeah.
across the solar system. So
like,
doing
like
science
the
is very
Federation.
Different.
You're the
yeah.
Federation.
I mean, for instance, I look at doing more science on Mars. You can come with a hypothesis, a PhD student come with a hypothesis. We have two orbiters and two landers. We can send command, make them take data or make a measurement and so on, look at it in your lab, do some new hypothesis, send it back. So we think about them like the stations in Antarctica.
Uh-huh.
You know, you have except
right.
it's on another planet.
Right.
You know, and
right.
it's robotic.
A minor
so
detail.
Science,
yeah.
science is completely
That's so
different.
Great. Adore, doesn't he sound like a proud father?
He certainly does, but I was just trying to visualize what 17 spacecraft all over the solar system would look like exactly.
Well, if you go into the mission control, they've got all these plots of the satellite stations that are communicating down to Earth, and they have scheduled times when they're supposed to check in with each of them. They check in with Voyager out near Pluto at a certain time, and then they go to Saturn and check in with Cassini, and then there's the SOHO Sun probe and all the Mars stuff, and there's stuff on the surface of Mars and the stuff orbiting Mars. And Charles Alachi suggested that at the end of May, there's going to be another landing on Mars, and he talked again about the 7 minutes of terror that we alluded to at the top of the show. When they land stuff on Mars, I mean, their hearts go into their throats.
Thousands of things have to happen right during those 6-7 what I call minutes of terror. And if one of them goes wrong, you know, we'll crash. You know, I mean, you have parachutes have to open, heat shield have to be deployed, retro rockets have to fire, legs have to open, radar has to work. So, and it's all in 6 minutes.
Six
you are coming at 12
minutes of terror.
We call it the 7 minutes of terror.
7 minutes of terror.
Because from the time you slam at the top of the atmosphere until you have to gently land is about 7 minutes. And you are coming in at 12,000 miles per hour at that speed, and you have to come just like this, you know, on the surface with this big machine.
How much do you age during those 7 minutes of terror?
The way I say it, I age like 5 years, but then when it's successful, I already gave those 5 years.
Isn't great? And at the end of May, the Phoenix probe is going to be the 18th of spaceship that they have up there.
That's pretty incredible. 420 seconds. That is a lot to happen then. What are they learning, John?
Well, you know, it's interesting. They're learning all kinds of things about the sun. They've created data collection points for scientists all over the world to have access to the solar system at all kinds of points. And the amazing thing that Charles Alachi said to me, they don't use the latest technology on this stuff that they launch. They don't buy the first iPhone, for instance. They make sure it's tested technology, so they deliberately use old stuff because they know it works.
Oh, so. To advance in our technology, we don't use the latest widget because we want to make sure it works. Because once we launch... You know, so we need things, we test them for 2-3 years. So we are always 2-3 years behind in technology, but it's on purpose. What we used
to
make...
You're not ordering the iPhone right out of the box.
Not yet.
No.
Matter of fact, we are testing it now. So we wait until... because we want to make sure all the bugs are out of it, all the things are out of it.
It's all about comfort zone, not having the flashiest technology. I love him.
Good to know it works. Good to know it works. We're going to get back to you, John, in Los Angeles. But right now, we're going to get some more headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello there. It is 27 minutes past the hour. In the news today, Senator Clinton continues her campaign. Senator Obama is in Washington. Conservative leader Silvio Berlusconi began his third stint as premier. That's in Italy. The 71-year-old media mogul already served as premier for 5 years. He faces the difficult task of kickstarting a sluggish economy and boosting productivity. Elsewhere in your global news, we have Pakistan, who admitted to testing a short-range cruise missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead on Thursday. That was just one day after arch-rival India test-fired a long-range missile with also nuclear capability. The 220-mile range Pakistani missile was set off a few hours ago. This week, it is Israel's birthday, 60th birthday actually today. Air shows, concerts and fireworks will mark the 6 decades since the Jewish state was founded. For Palestinians, this time is marked as Nakba, or catastrophe, in memory of hundreds of thousands dispossessed in the war. Vladimir Putin has stepped down as Russia's president and stepped up as Russia's prime minister. He handed off the torch to his protege, Dmitry Medvedev, to renounce Medvedev, who started his job yesterday.
It's a tough name.
I know.
Medvedev, 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 Medvedev.
Oh,
how many times
so
do I
much.
Have to say Medvedev?
I need more vodka, then I get it right perfectly. Moving on from Russia. To renounce Islam, a Malaysian woman needed much more than faith. She needed a court go-ahead. Sitavar Teman, Tan Abdul, fought a 2-year court battle to renounce Islam and revert back to Christianity. Religious courts rarely allow Muslims to convert, but her lawyer says her recent victory is a landmark decision. And that's a look at your international news headlines. Adora.
Certainly a lot going on in the world, isn't there?
Absolutely. And of course, we'll keep you up to date with the latest from Burma, also known as Myanmar.
Right, exactly, where aid planes have actually begun landing with lots of food and critical medical resources and other things that the folks there need, particularly in the area hit hard by the cyclone, which is down south. Takeaway question, if you were headed to space for a weekend, who would you take and what would you bring? We want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses 2 boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, May 7th, and we're following relief efforts in Myanmar following the catastrophic cyclone. We're also taking a look at the presidential race for the Democratic nominee, and we're looking at the question, if you were to travel for space for a weekend, who would you take and what would you bring? And Bill tells us, I'd take Congress about 300,000 miles away, make them observe the Earth for a weekend and hope they're inspired. We want to hear from you, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we're also this morning going to take a look at a cultural trend. For many years, the folks on Broadway, the people who produce plays, thought that African-American audiences could not sustain a play. In other words, they weren't willing to invest the money in order to put together a production that they thought would really attract African-American audiences. But what they've discovered is that that's not true, that if you create a play that is of great interest to African-American audiences, they will sustain it. And Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence Magazine, joins us, and he's just seen The Country Girl and Thurgood, two of the shows that are very much been targeting or that have very much targeted that African-American audience.
Absolutely. The big story here is that, you know, dramas have an enormously difficult time surviving on Broadway, and the fact that you have three, Cat in the Hot Tin Roof, Thurgood, and The Country Girl, that are doing enormous business. And a large part of that is due to African-American audiences and also word of mouth from African-American theater goers who are suggesting to their friends, their church members, their book club members to go back again and again.
Now, Hot Tin Roof is an all-Black cast.
All-Black cast. James Earl Jones, Anikanoni Rose, Terrence Howard, and Felicia Rashad.
Now, it actually, last week, it was the number two play on Broadway behind Macbeth. It brought in about $500,000, which is good news for Broadway because for many years, ticket sales have been lagging.
Ticket sales have been lagging. And also, this is a play that has not been embraced by critics. You know, it was also seen as a misfire just when it was coming together. Stephen Bird, the producer, had no theatrical experience when he mounted the play. This was what he felt was a dream cast. A lot of people, you know, didn't like the casting of Anikanoni Rose as Maggie the Cat, you know, who, you know, famously played and filmed by Elizabeth Taylor. What people don't know about the original Cat in the Hot Tin Roof is that Maggie was played by Barbara Bel Geddes, Miss Ellie from Dallas, who, you know, who had always been called handsome her entire career.
That's a great detail. You know, the critics are all wet on this one. They missed the success of Color Purple. I mean, what's interesting to me is George Wolfe at the Public Theater, prominent African-American director, and also the August Wilson plays on Broadway, certainly not as successful as these. What do you think tipped the balance to show the audience that this was really an option where these other prominent African-American producers and playwrights haven't been able to, you know, to make the business model work in the past?
John, it really was about the grassroots outreach. It really was moving beyond the city, moving beyond the Upper West Side and the influencers there, and going to Long Island and to Queens and to Brooklyn and New Jersey and Connecticut, connecting with those, you know, people who lived in those communities, reaching out to African-American radio stations, African-American websites. Long before the critics even knew that Cat in a Hot Tin Roof was coming, there had been buzz about it, you know, like even a year before, that Debbie Allen was possibly going to direct, that George Wolfe was going to direct, that James Earl Jones would or wouldn't do it. In fact, there's the rumor that James Earl Jones passed up the opportunity to play Thurgood, who Lawrence Fishburne is playing to great reviews now, to take the defining role as Big Daddy in Cat in a Hot Tin Roof.
And you mentioning Thurgood. Let's take a listen to Lawrence Fishburne.
My parents named me after my grandfather, Thurgood, Thurgood. It's my second grade. I got tired of writing out all those letters. I cut it to Thurgood. I was born in 1908, the year that William Howard Taft was elected president, and the year that Jack Johnson knocked out Tommy Burns. A Negro was the heavyweight champion of the world.
Now, typically, it is estimated that 4 out of 5 Broadway customers are white. Patrick, you went to go see this performance, and you say it was far more mixed than that.
It was far more mixed, far more diverse in terms of the ages of African-Americans who attended Thurgood the night I saw it, which is a week out of his opening. And what's really fascinating here, when you look at the topics of the plays, you're talking about Cat in a Hot Tin Roof, where the word spastic colon is, you know, uttered more than I've ever heard the word spastic colon before. You know, mendacity, latent homosexuality, you know, 2 hours and 45 minutes. Thurgood Marshall, which looks at basically Brown versus Board of Education and how it came into being. The Country Girl, alcoholism, possible suicide attempt. These are not like moments in a theater. This is miles away from Tyler Perry's plays, you know, where there's characters in drag and very broad comedy, possible male strippers in some of the productions like Grandma Prayed for Me or Grandma Don't. But many of these performances are being seen, the dramas at least, by people who saw those Tyler Perry plays that played at the Beacon Theater here in New York.
What's the significance of those themes to you, the differences?
Well, it means that African-American audiences are a very underserved audience in terms of reflections of our lives. You know, so whether it's Morgan Freeman playing the husband of Frances McDormand in The Country Girl, whether it's Thurgood Marshall, whether it's, you know, African-American family in the 50s where there's a plantation owner and a bunch of plotting and scheming, that we want to see representations of our lives, far more diverse portrayals of our lives than we could get on television, than we can get, you know, in movies, you know, so.
And that's a huge motivator. And you're talking about Morgan Freeman and Frances McDormand. Let's take a quick listen to The Country Girl.
You walk off this show, too, you'll never see me again.
Oh, right. Take everybody else's part. Never mind how I'm feeling. Just take everybody else's part.
This year, I'm taking my own part.
Why'd you ever marry me?
That's easy. You always had chiclets in your pocket.
Chiclets in your pocket. So, Patrick, in your estimation, we're sure to see more plays very quickly.
Right. For Color Girls Who've Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough, which is not a laugh a minute in the theater, is coming in August, produced by Whoopi Goldberg, starring Indy Irie. And there's talk that the producer for Cat in a Hot Tin Roof is going to mount a multicultural revival of Streetcar Named Desire with the actress Lynn Whitfield.
Very interesting. Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Femi, will you have some headlines for us?
I certainly do. It is 20 minutes to the hour. Just pulled off from the Newswire, the story about the Labor Department. They have released the numbers of newly laid off workers in the last 7 days. The figures are down. They're now 365,000 in 1 week, down 18,000 people. As we talk again about finance and the economy, consumer borrowing unexpectedly rose in March at its fastest pace in 4 months. It was 3.1% in February and more than doubled to 7.2% the next month. In sports news, the Swiss government has agreed to ease restrictions on the importation of potatoes, following fears that the Euro 2008 soccer fans could face a shortage of French fries next month.
It's potato sports. It's not sports, it's potato s'mores. I have to snort on that one.
Thank you for snorting out there on the West Coast. Very much appreciated. A spokesman for the country's Department of Agriculture told National Radio on Wednesday that the government would allow an additional 5,000 tons of potatoes to be brought in, and they're all going to be made into chips. Translation, fries.
Fries, thanks.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Yes, the mission. Here I am at Southern California Public Radio, KPCC, in Pasadena, where we spent the evening at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which motivates our takeaway question this morning. And that, of course, is if you had 3 days to spend in space, who would you do? Where would you go? Who would you take? We had a call, Adora, from JPL. Actually, they're actually interested in Patrick's mission to take the Funkadelics to Uranus. They think that actually that has some legs, and I think he should do a National Science Foundation grant on that. But we actually posed the question. Let me just get to this quickly. We posed the question of where they would go to the late night workers at JPL last night, and here was one of their responses.
What about a place for some, like, you know, weekend of really awesome anti gravity extreme sports? What would be a good location for that?
The moon or probably Mars? Yeah,
moon or Mars.
Yeah, I think moon would be good though.
Yeah,
because the moon's got all the craters and everything, so you can have some good times while off road in there.
You can definitely catch some air.
And you got a great, yeah. I mean, it's got low gravity, so you can get some good air. Got a great view of the Earth. You know, so
not bad.
I would say moon would be good.
Moon for that.
Absolutely.
That's the guy who keeps the rovers happy overnight, Adora. He's the guy who actually manipulates the rovers.
You said make them happy. I like that. It's Rich tells us on our website, I'd like to convince my wife, he's trying to keep himself happy, convince my wife to go canoeing on one of the lakes of Titan, Saturn, hanging over our space-helmeted heads. But I think it would be a pretty hard sell.
Also be a very expensive vacation there on Titan. But, you know, Charles Alachi of JPL said last night that they believe at JPL that Europa, another moon of Saturn, actually has life. Or no, moon of Jupiter. Or now I don't know, and I have to check. It's either Jupiter or Saturn. Oh, I am in trouble now. I am in such email trouble now. Here's another response from some of the JPLers.
How about you, if you were going for a weekend?
That is a good question. I think for the view, I guess I'll go with Saturn.
For the view?
Yeah, it's just a great view. I mean, just the rings, it's just an amazing planet. Because Mars is probably a typical answer, but, you know, we've seen so many images of Mars, plus all the various movies of Mars, you know, so it's kind of an orange, kind of a desert kind of planet. So I think I'd cruise around. I like Saturn.
The after-hour crew at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Are there other responses from actual humans?
Saturn's pretty popular. We have an actual human in the studio here. That's Patrick Henry Bass, the senior editor at Essence. Besides Funkadelic, what else do you think you'd like to explore up there in the galaxy?
I want to go to the same place where Michael Jordan went in Space Jam.
Where is
he was? He was with the Warner Brothers cartoon folks.
Oh right!
Remember that where they fought the aliens?
That's right.
Wasn't it amazing?
Right.
They had a basketball game. I'd bring Michael, Daffy, you know, Elmer Fudd.
They don't eat much. Those animated characters don't eat much. They actually function very well in a zero gravity, zero oxygen environment.
But don't you think it'd be contractual hell to try to get them all together?
That's true.
That would be certainly interesting.
You could arrange it.
Who knows? Elizabeth Zimmer says, I want to be in space with Gene Robinson, a Canadian choreographer who's been jonesing to dance in zero gravity for more than 35 years. We want to hear where you would go, who you would take. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
Yeah.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We're following aid efforts in Myanmar following the cyclone that hit on Sunday. We understand the first aid plane has actually landed in the country. Also, we're taking a look at the presidential nomination process and the pressure on Senator Hillary Clinton to drop out of the race. Another story for us today is what's happening in Russia. Today, the former president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, will be sworn in as prime minister. A very unusual turn of events, this coming after a very successful 8-year run by him leading the country, which saw the economy booming and unemployment shrinking and his popularity soaring. At the same time, Putin's been harshly criticized for clamping down on the press, clamping down on civil liberties, and for a leadership style many describe as more dictatorial than democratic. Edward Lucas reports for The Economist and just wrote the book, The New Cold War. Edward, you say that Russia poses a direct menace not only to its own citizens, but to outsiders. Explain that for us.
Yes. First of all, to the people of Russia, the record of the Kremlin and the ex-KGB people who've been running it over the last 8 years is pretty poor. They had a very good moment in the economic cycle when they took over and oil prices have been high, so living standards shot up, but the record on infrastructure and public services has been pretty bad, and Russia's in some way been falling behind the rest of the world. And they're also a threat to the outside because these problems leak. There's Russian money is flooding into Eastern Europe, buying politicians, political parties, sometimes even countries. And it's also having a bad effect on Western Europe, particularly in Germany, which has now become a kind of Trojan horse for Russian influence inside both NATO and the EU.
You have an interesting dynamic here because you have Vladimir Putin, who was a very strong force in Russia, becoming prime minister, and the president, Dmitry Medvedev, He's a former natural gas executive. He's never been elected to office before. He's a friend of Putin's. How do the two of them rule? And he has been, Medvedev has been making noises of perhaps making the press a little freer and taking government action out of the economy.
Well, it's very hard to see what Mr. Medvedev is going to be able to do. The Russian political scene is absolutely dominated by the towering figure of Vladimir Putin, who has really destroyed all the independent institutions of the country over the last 8 years. It's a political system that's now based on personality, and his personality is the big one. But just as the symbol of Russia is the double-headed eagle, which looks great in heraldry but couldn't fly in practice, I don't really see how the double-headed political system is going to work. The Constitution really envisages a strong president, and an American-style president, and a fairly weak prime minister who does what he's told. So now we have the strongest guy in the country as the prime minister and this kind of figurehead president, which doesn't really fit the Constitution. So we genuinely don't know, and we're back to guesswork. It's back to Kremlinology, because the political system is so closed. And that was a technique we used during the Cold War back in the early 1980s to try and work out what's going on. I thought it had gone out with the telex machine and the slide rule, but now we're back to using it again.
The telex machine. What do you think these two men, what do you think, or how do you think this dynamic is going to affect the relationship with the U.S.?
I think one of the reasons that they've put Mr. Medvedev in as the president is to try and present a better image to the West, because he's not an ex-KGB guy. He's a lawyer. He speaks English. He's from if not the younger generation, certainly he's younger than most world leaders at 42. And I think that this may reflect a feeling in some people, among some parts of the Russian elite, that things have gone a bit too far under Mr. Putin, that Russia's image was becoming too threatening. But I'm not sure whether that's going to be the dominant thing, because at the same time as Mr. Medvedev comes in, we're seeing extremely threatening and unpleasant behaviour towards Georgia. And tomorrow we're going to see a military parade in Red Square, where for the first time since the end of the old Cold War, we're going to see nuclear missiles and tanks trundling through.
Nuclear missiles and tanks, that's certainly going to hearken some images from the past. Edward Lucas, who reports for The Economist and just authored the book, The New Cold War. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sean?
Well, I'm out here at Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena at KPCC, obviously Southern California is not just about satellites in space, much as I love spending time at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And we thought, as we were out here, we would take a look at some of the sort of social cultural issues that bear actually fairly directly on some of the political issues that are going to be important in November. And if you wanted to gauge the pulse or kind of take a slice of the culture of the Latino community, and particularly the immigrant community in Southern California, you couldn't do much better than to read the OC Weekly, Orange County, California, column of author Gustavo Arellano, whose weekly column called Ask a Mexican really poses some provocative questions and unearths issues that are really, really important to the community here and probably have some pretty important national implications as well. Gustavo is here with me at this ungodly hour at the KPCC studios. Gustavo, thanks for coming in.
Gracias for having me.
Now, there are a number of stories that you've talked about, but in general, what kind of a window do you have on this population here in Southern California, and how do we understand the kinds of issues that you're talking about in your column from a national perspective?
I have an immediate window because both my parents were immigrants. My dad was an illegal immigrant. He came to this country in the trunk of a Chevy in 1968. He's now a citizen because of the Amnesty Act of 1986. When I entered kindergarten, the only language I spoke was Spanish. And now, of course, here you're interviewing me in English. And I think I talk pretty good English by this point. So
No, it really sucks.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, I tried.
Could you switch to Spanish, please?
No, como que no? Ahorita no lo voy a hacer.
Now I'm in trouble.
Lo trato de hacer.
But gracias, gracias.
The point I'm trying to make is that in my family, just in my 29 years, we've seen this entire argument about illegal immigration boil down with our family, and I'm not the exception. I'm the rule. And so I know what's going on in the immigrant community. I know what's going on, and I know what's going to happen with all these Mexicans coming to this
country. Well, can I ask a Mexican?
Sure.
Why border agents at the border in Southern California appear to be targeting immigrants who are leaving the country for a customs inspection?
Because at this point, ICE just wants to harass illegal immigrants.
Well, explain the story. Explain the details.
So what happened, the LA Times a couple of days ago, they reported that 100 yards from the Mexico border, as you're heading down south toward toward Tijuana, ICE agents, they're stopping buses, they're stopping cars, and they're asking people to see their documentation.
And apprehending them.
And apprehending them.
Exactly. Even though they're on their way out.
Even though they're on their way out. Their claim is that they want to document every single person that's leaving the country to make sure they know who is illegal, just in case they try to sneak back into the country, that they know not to allow them in the country because they don't have any papers.
Do people accept the security argument here, or does it feel more like a show of force to the community?
It's harassment. The United States has always loved to harass immigrants, you know, bat them around. Of course, in the 1950s, Eisenhower had Operation Wetback. During the 1930s, there was a repatriation.
Of course, the government would say, hey, they're targets. They're in here illegally. It doesn't matter which way the bus is pointed. If we catch them, we got them.
But they do that, and then we'll go a good 1 to 2 decades where we don't do anything at all. We just sort of turn away and allow people to hire these illegal immigrants, and we gladly also take the Social Security money that these illegal immigrants don't claim, that a lot of bankers are saying are what now is propping up Social Security. So, you know, we like to have it both ways, and I think it's hypocritical.
You also, let me again ask a Mexican.
Sure.
When L.A. cracks down on taco trucks on the streets of Los Angeles, all hell breaks loose. Why?
When L.A. cracks down on taco trucks, you know something's wrong with this country.
Let's just say these are really popular places to get lunches and dinners. They're social gathering places, and they have great food.
It's just like the street cart vendors of New York. It's a cultural institution in Los Angeles. And so in East Los Angeles specifically, which isn't part of Los Angeles proper. It's unincorporated East Los Angeles. They're going to put in an ordinance that allows taco trucks only to stay in one place for half an hour as opposed to the rest of the day. It's going to kill the business.
And it's inflamed whites, Latinos, old, young. It's really interesting.
It's United, yeah. It's United Southern California in a way that only Vin Scully's voice for the Dodgers does.
That's Gustavo Arellano, staff writer for the OC Weekly of Orange County, California. He's also the author of the new paperback edition of his Ask a Mexican. They are a combination of all of his columns. It's in bookstores right now, John.
Yeah, Gustavo is great. It was great of him to come in, and it's got some great columns in there. Anyway, so everyone's still in space, right?
Yes. We're asking, if you were to go there, where would you go, and who would you take with you? And this is what we got from someone. Listen.
My name is Dominic Jeremy. But I would love to take my friends Marcel, my friend Nicholas, my friend Matthew, and my friend Aaron on the trip with me. It was so awesome. I also love to stare out the window and stare at space and the constellations. Oh my God, that would be so awesome. I would really love to. I really would. So please listen to my message. Bye.
That is so great.
What a wondrous voice. He's like, that would be awesome.
Oh, maybe we could take some tacos into space.
Maybe take
tacos into space. Funkadelics. We are changing the world here.
We are. So we're asking you to keep those thoughts coming about where you'd go in space to 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We've got tons of ways to join the conversation. I'm out here at KPCC in Pasadena. You can watch some video of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at thetakeaway.org, and we'll have more from the Sirius Play Conference that I'm here at on the Takeaway tomorrow.
Okay, see you later, John.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.